Hello and welcome to Science World.
What we now think is going on is the thunderstorm acts like a gigantic particle accelerator. Strong fields inside the thunderstorm accelerate electrons to almost the speed of light, and then they make the gamma rays. This is a very big electrical discharge, but because it doesn't involve a hot channel, it's almost completely dark, so you wouldn't see it or you wouldn't hear anything if this went off.
Most of us are already familiar with the dangers and the havoc that can be caused by lightning. Now, scientists are saying that lightning, believe it or not, has an even darker side and is capable of generating brief but powerful bursts of gamma radiation. Today, we'll talk with a scientist whose team has conducted research into a phenomenon called dark lightning. Roseanne Skirbel will tell us how NASA is adapting some of the same tools it used to learn about water on the moon, minerals on Mars, and the composition of exoplanets to analyze ecosystems on our own planet Earth. A top official from the World Health Organization says that the new H7N9 strain of bird flu in China that has already killed some 22 people and has spread throughout 7 provinces and municipalities is one of the most lethal of its kind to date. And of course, we'll have another edition of the Science World Quick Quiz. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science Health and Technology magazine, Science World. NASA is adapting some of the same tools it used to learn about water on the moon, minerals on Mars, and the composition of exoplanets to analyze ecosystems on our own planet, Earth. Roseanne Skirbel reports on preliminary high-altitude tests of a new Earth imaging technology that NASA plans eventually to launch into Earth orbit.
There's only room for the pilot on NASA's ER-2, a flying laboratory that skirts the edge of space at an altitude of 20,000 meters, nearly 2 times higher than any commercial jet. On board are imaging tools that gather data on how different wavelengths of light interact with molecules and particles in the landscape below to produce a spectral fingerprint.
It looks at light in many very narrow colors that both include the wavelengths that our eyes see, but also extend, in my case, well into the infrared, where we can see the interaction of other molecules in unique ways.
Robert Green is a scientist with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and principal investigator on the Hyperspectral Infrared Imager, or HISPRI, airborne campaign. He says the sensors in an onboard instrument called the Airborne Visible Infrared Imaging Spectrometer precisely measure the light and temperature characteristics of each ecosystem the plane flies over.
We can see the interaction of the molecules that are present in the Earth's atmosphere, such as water vapor and carbon dioxide, and on the Earth's surface in plants, such as cellulose and leaf water and the other constituents of plants.
It can also measure the impact of other events happening on the surface, like volcanic eruptions, wildfires, and droughts. This week, NASA ended a month of test flights of the imaging spectroscopy technology over California.
We have snow-covered mountains, we have coasts, we have agriculture, we have deserts, we have forested areas. So in one fairly small region of the country, we can capture a tremendous diversity of ecosystems and environments found on the surface of the Earth.
Green says each pixel captured by the imager holds a wealth of information invisible to the human eye.
We can map the species type. We can look at the biogeochemistry of the plant. What is the state of the chemicals in the leaves of the plants to tell us about their health and productivity? In the geology area, we can look at the different mineral signatures, which tell us the molecules in the rocks to know exactly what those minerals are. And this is all in preparation for the satellite mission.
Green says that mission will provide global coverage from low Earth orbit, about 700 kilometers above the planet.
This would give us global direct measurements of molecules and temperatures of the Earth's surface repeated each year, so we could see seasonal and temporal variations.
The HISPRI satellite mission is still in the study phase. Test flights on the ER-2 will continue through 2014. Green says the new images of the planet can help scientists better assess how the Earth is changing. The data can also help policymakers and the public make better decisions about how humans can adapt to those changes. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
A top World Health Organization official says a new strain of bird flu in China is one of the most lethal of its kind to date. To date, it has killed 22 people and has spread throughout 7 provinces and municipalities. Bill Ide reports from Beijing.
A group of World Health Organization specialists spoke with reporters Wednesday about the H7N9 virus, which has already infected more than 100 people in China. The WHO team arrived late last week for a 5-day visit to learn more about the new virus. Keiji Fukuda, the WHO Assistant Director for Health Security, says at this point there is still not enough evidence to show the virus can spread easily from human to human.
When we look at influenza viruses, this is an unusually dangerous virus for humans. Based on the evidence that we see, we think that this virus is more easily transmitted from poultry to humans than H5N1.
The H5N1 strain of bird flu surfaced in 2003. Over the past decade, it has swept across 3 continents and killed more than half of the 622 people it has infected. WHO and Chinese health officials stress the effort to understand the new strain is still in its early stages. Liang Wannin of the National Health and Family Planning Commission says just how effective the government's prevention measures will be remains unclear. He says the extent of public health risk from the virus is uncertain as well. Liang says there are many facets of the disease that are not yet understood. He says there are many things that still need to be studied and learned about the new virus. Chinese and WHO scientists all agree that birds infected by the virus, especially poultry, are the likely sources of human infection. Nancy Cox, director of the flu division at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was also part of the WHO team.
So far, no samples from migratory birds or their habitats have been positive for H7N9. In contrast, samples from chickens, ducks, and pigeons have been positive for H7N9 from poultry markets. Also, environmental samples taken from poultry markets have been positive.
So far, the majority of deaths and infections from the new strain have occurred in Shanghai. Like many other cities where the virus has cropped up, authorities there have closed down live poultry markets in response. Ann Kelson, director of the WHO Flu Research Center in Melbourne, Australia, says the market closings appear to be helping.
Now, we know that Shanghai rapidly, on the 6th of April, closed down the live poultry markets in that municipality. And it's been very encouraging to see that almost immediately there was a decline in the detection of new cases. And the cases that did occur all occurred in the next week, which you might expect to be within the incubation period of the virus.
Still, Kelson adds that this is no reason to relax. She says close monitoring of the impact the closure of such facilities should continue in the weeks and months to come. Although Chinese authorities say more than half of those infected have been individuals who had direct contact with poultry or birds, how the remaining number of those infected contracted the virus is less certain. The government has carried out tens of thousands of tests on birds, but only several dozen have turned up positive. And in one of the 2 cases of bird flu in Beijing so far, a young boy contracted the virus without showing any symptoms of H7N9. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. Astronomers have been noticing traces of water in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter for the last 15 years and have wondered where it came from. Well, this past Tuesday, the European Space Agency said that they think the mysterious H2O came from a comet that struck the giant planet nearly 19 years ago. The ESA noted that the water molecules are clustered at a high altitude above Jupiter around the sites where 21 comet fragments smacked into Jupiter back in July of 1994. So, for this week's quick quiz, we want to know the name of that comet in which has been described as one of the most spectacular recorded events in astronomy. Was it Comet A, Shoemaker-Levy 9, B, Hale-Bopp, or C, Kohoutek? Think about it a little bit and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll let you know the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Last Sunday, when Orbital Sciences' Antares rocket launched from NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia on its first test flight, the privately built booster placed into orbit several new mini-satellites built mainly with smartphone components. Suzanne Presto has more on what they're calling phone sets.
Smartphones. We carry them in our pockets, toss them in our tote bags, and have them at the ready whenever we want directions to a destination, or to snap a picture, or to call a friend. Perhaps we're often guilty of taking the gadget's microprocessing powers for granted. Not so with NASA, which just sent three smartphones into space as low-cost satellites. The three so-called phone sats are named Alexander, Graham, and Bell, after the inventor of the telephone. The phone sats are small cubes, each about the size of a beverage mug and weighing a little more than a kilogram. At the core of each is a Google HTC Nexus One phone, whose zippy little microprocessor, running the Android operating system, serves as the onboard computer. Jim Cockrell, the phone sat project manager at NASA's Ames Research Center in California, described the project in a video broadcast on NASA TV ahead of the Antares launch.
Someone here asked the question, can we fly a cell phone as the avionics for a satellite and have something that's very capable but really, really inexpensive? So PhoneSat was launched to try to answer that question.
NASA says the three PhoneSats are operating in orbit, and transmissions from the trio have been received at various ground stations here on Earth. Engineers spent between $3,500 and $7,000 for the PhoneSat components. They did add a larger external lithium-ion battery bank and a more powerful radio to send messages. The space agency says smartphones have more than 100 times the computing power of an average satellite. Researchers such as NASA's Cockrell note that smartphones come equipped with fast processors, high-resolution cameras, global positioning system receivers, radios, and sensors.
The smartphone vendors have put a lot of R&D money into making very, very capable microprocessors that have a lot of processing power and speed in a package that's very rugged.
Researchers will continue to monitor the satellites, which could remain in orbit for about 2 weeks. The phone sats will attempt to take pictures of our planet, as well as send information via radio back to Earth. Think about that next time you pull your phone from your pocket. But don't think about texting Alexander, Graham, or Bell. NASA says it has disabled their ability to send and receive calls and texts. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking of smartphones, mobile phone use in Africa has spread far, wide, and fast. Now the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says it's using the technology to save lives. Joe DeCapua reports.
In Kenya, the IFRC has developed the Rapid Mobile Phone-Based Survey, otherwise known as RAMP. It allows the medical aid group to learn a lot about the health of people in remote rural communities in very little time. Jason Pete, the senior health officer for malaria, says the idea for the survey came from IFRC volunteers.
There are volunteers using those mobile phones to communicate. They're doing it two ways. They're using them as a regular phone, but more often than not, we see them use the phones to send text messages back and forth because it's a very inexpensive way to communicate. Red Cross volunteers and other community health workers at a very local level were already figuring out a way to manage activities, to manage programs, and not just health programs, but all programs using mobile phones.
Volunteers use RAMP to collect data on such things as antenatal and newborn care, immunizations, malaria, pneumonia, diarrhea, and other health issues. Pete says the mobile phone survey has sharply reduced costs. It's 10 times cheaper compared to the old clipboard method, and it saves a lot of time.
It's incredibly quick. I mean, we have a data bulletin in 24 hours, where it took us months to generate a data bulletin before, and we can have a written report within 3 days. I mean, to be straight, it requires a person, you know, sitting behind a computer and putting in a full day. But in all the ramps we've done to date, we've had data bulletin out in 24 hours, and we've had the first draft of the survey report out in 3 days.
The faster the information is gathered, the faster the response.
This tool allows us very quickly to get to the root of the issue. It allows us to say immediately, these are where we have problems. These are where we want to change the health indicators. And this tool gives us that data. And the nice thing about it is you can monitor progress very quickly.
The World Health Organization and top epidemiologists help the Red Cross develop RAMP. The mobile phone survey is being used to help Kenya and other African countries reach the Millennium Development Goals on health. The target date for the MDGs is 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Okay, let's find out if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Astronomers have been noticing traces of water in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter for the last 15 years and have wondered where it came from. This past Tuesday, the European Space Agency said that they think the mysterious H2O came from a comet that struck the giant planet nearly 19 years ago. The ESA noted that the water molecules are clustered at a high altitude above Jupiter, around the sites where 21 comet fragments smacked into Jupiter back in July 1994. Now, what we wanted to know is the name of that comet, and which has been described as one of the most spectacular recorded events in astronomy. Was it Comet A, Shoemaker-Levy 9, B, Hale-Bopp, or C, Kohoutek? Well, the comet that hit Jupiter and provided the world with a spectacular show back in the summer of 1994 was A, Shoemaker-Levy 9, or D/1993F2, as it's formerly called. The comet that caused the entire ruckus was discovered in March 1993 by astronomers Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker and David Levy. Thanks so much for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Have you ever heard of a phenomenon called dark lightning? No, I'm not making this up, and it's not science fiction either. For almost 10 years, scientists have known that thunderstorms that already cause so much havoc for those of us on Earth has an even darker side and can generate powerful bursts of gamma rays that have been called terrestrial gamma ray flashes, or TGFs. Fortunately, while these bursts of gamma radiation are brief, they have been reported to be so bright that they can blind instruments many hundreds of kilometers away in outer space. Professor Joseph Dwyer and his colleagues from the Florida Institute of Technology have been researching dark lightning and have developed what they described as a promising physics-based model of exactly how thunderstorms manage to produce high-energy radiation. Since it's been found that dark lightning can originate near the same altitudes as those flown regularly by commercial aircraft, scientists have been trying to find out whether or not these TGFs present a radiation hazard to airplane passengers. Professor Dwyer joins us this week for our one-on-one segment to talk about dark lightning and what he and his team have learned about this strange phenomenon. Dr. Dwyer, what is dark lightning?
A few years back, spacecraft started seeing these bursts of gamma rays coming up from the Earth's atmosphere. And this was very strange. The Earth is not supposed to make gamma rays. If you want to study gamma rays, you usually look for places like black holes and supernovas. We figured out eventually that these gamma rays were coming from ordinary thunderstorms. So we were trying to figure out how a thunderstorm deep in the atmosphere can make these energetic gamma rays. Now, gamma rays, just to step back a second, are energetic X-rays. They're hundreds of times more energetic than the kind of X-rays you would see at a doctor's office. So something very unusual was going on. Normal lightning is very hot. It's about five times as hot as the surface of the sun. And because of that, it emits a lot of light. But compared to the gamma ray energy scale, it's downright cold. So normal lightning's not hot enough to make the kind of gamma rays we've been seeing. So we need some other explanation. What we now think is going on is the thunderstorm acts like a gigantic particle accelerator. Strong fields inside the thunderstorm accelerate electrons to almost the speed of light, and then they make the gamma rays. And so we get this sort of exotic kind of discharge involving all these high-energy particles that makes the gamma ray burst. It actually can discharge the thunderstorm faster than normal lightning. So this is a very big electrical discharge. But because it doesn't involve a hot channel, it's almost completely dark. So you wouldn't see it or you wouldn't hear anything if this went off.
From what I understand, Dr. Dwyer, this phenomenon takes place high in the atmosphere where commercial airlines fly. Now, does this pose any danger at all to human beings who perhaps may fly through one of these storms?
Because dark lightning makes so many gamma rays and so many energetic electrons, it is a concern if an aircraft were in the wrong place at the wrong time. That sort of the altitudes that this happens is right in the middle of thunderstorms and towards the upper parts of thunderstorms, which is about the same altitude range that commercial aircraft fly. But there's also some good news here. First of all, pilots do their best to stay away from thunderstorms. Thunderstorms are dangerous places. We all know that already. So, you know, no additional warning is needed. Pilots already do a really good job steering around thunderstorms. And the second piece of good news is dark lightning appears to be relatively rare. Maybe one out of every 1,000 normal lightning flashes would be dark lightning. So combining those two, people really should not be worrying about this.
Dr. Dwyer, have you noticed any certain conditions or circumstances where gamma radiation is more or less likely to be generated by these storms?
Spacecraft tend to see the gamma rays from these storms more in the around the equatorial region of our planet, but that could be because those just tend to be taller thunderstorms, so the source of the gamma rays is closer to outer space. There's less atmosphere to go through. So that just could be an observational bias. As far as we can tell, most thunderstorms should be capable of generating these gamma rays, of generating dark lightning. We don't know exactly which kinds of thunderstorms do it. We're not exactly certain what's happening inside the thunderstorm that makes one more likely to generate this kind of discharge, and then maybe some others don't. So this is all still research in progress.
And looking over the material about your findings, Dr. Dwyer, according to a model your team created, instead of lightning, sometimes thunderstorms can produce an exotic kind of electrical breakdown that involves high-energy electrons and their antimatter equivalent called positrons. Now, are you saying that dark lightning can actually produce antimatter?
Yes, that's actually how it works. So when you're accelerating particles to almost the speed of light, kind of like you would see at a particle laboratory, a high-energy laboratory like CERN, when you get particles going at that energy, they make lots of gamma rays, and these can make matter in the antimatter version of the electron called the positron. Now, this sounds like science fiction, but it really does happen. And so you get so many positrons created that they allow you to sort of unlock all the electrical energy that's inside the thunderstorm. So it sounds strange, but yes, we think it really happens.
In order to better study this phenomenon, assuming that this study is continuing, you and your team are suggesting that a special dedicated satellite be launched to study the phenomenon. Can you tell us a little more about this?
What we're talking about here. So it would be very nice to have instruments that were specifically designed to measure what we're interested in studying. And, you know, this is we're talking about something that's happening right over our heads that, you know, that could affect people that, you know, that may be relatively common, and so it would be very interesting to learn more about this.
That was Professor Joseph Dwyer from the Department of Physics at the Florida Institute of Technology. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.